welcome to episode 199 of Eating the Fantastic, the podcast which packs you in my suitcase and takes you along on my convention travels so you can eavesdrop on my meals with creators of science fiction, horror, fantasy, comic books, and more. I'm Scott Edelman, and I've spent most of my life attending such conventions, and also wandering off to break bread with old friends and new, which turns out to be as much fun as the cons themselves. May took me to the Nebula Awards weekend in Anaheim, California, and Balticon in Baltimore, Maryland, and though the world conspired against me to prevent me from recording the episode I planned at that latter con, though don't worry, I'll try again with that guest in October during Capclave, I did return from California with 5 recorded conversations. The first of those guests with whom you'll hear me chat and chew is William Shun, who I first came into contact with in 1993 when I bought his short story, Colin and Ishmael in the Dark, for publication in Science Fiction Age magazine. We met in the flesh later that same year at the San Francisco Worldcon, and he's been part of my life for the past 30 years. Bill attended the Clarion Science Fiction Writers Workshop in 1985 when he was only 17, a class which included Mary Trezillo, Jeffrey Landis, Christine Catherine Rush, Risa Nelson, and other writers with whom you might be familiar, several of whom have been previous guests on the show. In addition to being published in Science Fiction Age, he's also appeared in Asimov's, Analog, Fantasy and Science Fiction, Realms of Fantasy, and other magazines. In 2002, he was nominated for a Nebula in the category of Novelette for Dance of the Yellow-Breasted Luddites, and a few years later hit the nomination trifecta when he was up for a Nebula, Hugo, and Sturgeon Award for his novella Inclination, which had been published in Asimov's in 2006. If you happen to be a writer, though, you might be familiar with the name Shun because of what's come to be called the Shun format, a guide to proper manuscript preparation which first appeared online in 1995 and has since become the gold standard for numerous publications. His widely acclaimed memoir, The Accidental Terrorist, Confessions of a Reluctant Missionary, was published in 2015, and in addition to detailing the youthful indiscretion which prevents him from ever returning to Canada, explains how Clarion changed his life and helped him become the writer he is today. And now that I think of it, that youthful indiscretion deserves a trigger warning, because what Bill did at age 17 was phone in a bomb threat in an attempt to prevent a fellow Mormon missionary from abandoning his post. That foolish choice is at the heart of his memoir, which would likely have been released by a major publisher if 9/11 had not happened years later, a disruption we discussed near the end of the interview. Though we don't dwell on the horrors of that day, only talk of how it affected publisher reactions to his book, which had gone on submission pre-9/11, if you find any mention of 9/11 to be triggering, you might want to skip over that section of the podcast when we get to talking about his book near the end of the episode. We got together at Ho Sen Vegetarian Restaurant, which, surprisingly for me, was the best meal I had while in California. I say surprisingly because I usually leave vegetarian restaurants hungering for a hamburger, but not here, where there was so much umami, I was satiated and satisfied for the rest of the day. If I'm ever back in Anaheim, believe me, I'll also be back at Ho Sen. As for the sound quality this time around, the ambient hubbub of this episode varies as other customers come and go during the lunch rush, but I've suppressed that as best as I can, and I believe Bill's wisdom clearly comes through. As always, I feel the trade-off of NPR You Could Hear a Pin Drop studio sound for the intimacy of joining us at a restaurant table where food relaxes us both and loosens my guest's tongue is worth it. Now please join our lunch in Anaheim, where we begin with some amazing fried mushrooms. Not to start off on a morbid note, because the last time I asked someone a question similar to this question, they died shortly thereafter. But I was thinking a lot about legacy, and I was wondering if you find it odd, thinking about the fact that there were so many people out there who know you for the Shun format more than for, oh, don't we, Shun is a writer? He didn't just come up with a format? And that perhaps, I don't want to bring you down thinking about what people will remember you for, but does it feel strange that there might be, that might live on forever, propagated through every magazine out there? Hopefully the fiction will be too, but I'm just wondering, how do you approach the thought of that side fame that...
I do think about it sometimes. I'm grateful that people have taken my proper manuscript format to heart, which isn't, it's odd to hear it called shun format because it's really not mine. It's what I learned at Clarion from Damon Knight, essentially. He had a manuscript guide that he handed out to us at Clarion, and it was much more efficient than mine. It told us everything we needed to know in 2 pages and was its own example of the format. So when I went to put a version of it online...
So you made it less efficient.
I made it less efficient.
Probably efficient is not... You mean less compact, let's
less
say,
compact,
right? I mean, I'm sure,
sure
it does the things that it's supposed to do, right?
Yes. So. Yeah. I wasn't even aware until maybe a few years ago that people called it shun format.
Really?
The first time I heard that, I had a really strong moment of cognitive dissonance. This is very strange.
It probably was to a magazine you were about to submit to, and it had your name.
It was someone coming up to me at a reading or a symposium or something and saying, "Oh, William Shun, shun format? Is that you?" Yes. It is. I've had someone recognize me from it at a movie theater. It's it's very strange. Yeah.
Because your face is
in New York
there,
City. I don't know why exactly. Maybe because my face is somewhere on the website.
Mm-hmm. And do they say thank you?
Usually, yes. Yeah.
Saved me from a lifetime of error.
At
least when I get rejected, I know it's for a purpose.
Right. I think it was actually Holly Black who came up to me at a reading like a couple of decades ago and said, "You know, thank you for that. You taught me how to format my first manuscript, and that's why I got published." Like, well, I'm glad I could help. So it's certainly not a legacy that I'm upset about. You know, I would like the fiction to get a little more attention at some point. But, you know, I've had my moment there too. Nebula and Hugo nominations, so I can't complain too much.
So it's all thanks to Damon Knight.
It's all thanks to Damon Knight, yes. And Damon and Kate, really.
Were they still around at the time that you started doing this, or were they gone already when the shun format happened?
I don't remember what year Damon passed away. I think he was still around.
Yeah.
I think so. I put my first version of that... of that guide on the web in 1995. Kate was definitely still around.
She was still around.
Yeah.
So when you went to Clarion, was that the first time you met actual writers at age 17? Unless there were people who came to school and, you know, gave presentations or things like that.
As far as I remember, I might have gone to someone's signing at some point before that, but essentially that was the first time I'd met other science fiction writers, or at least other people who had names in the science fiction field. I'd met some people who also wanted to write science fiction when I was growing up.
Yes. People who were as lost in the desert as you were, and as we were when we began.
Yeah, almost literally. I had friends that read science fiction, but it was not something. It was not something I was encouraged to read at home.
So why was it that year, or not the year before, or not the year after? Well, the year before you would have been 16, and that probably would have been far even as strange as it was for them to let a 17-year-old in. The 16-year-old was even.
I learned about Clarion through Asimov's Science Fiction magazine. I started subscribing to Asimov's, I think, when I was 15 or so. One of the first issues of the magazine that I got had an essay by Algis Budrys about what Clarion was all about. I think it was called Defending Clarion or something like that. And I read it. I read about this workshop you could go to and meet meet and learn from actual professional science fiction writers, and I thought that is what I want to do. And so I applied for the very next one that was open to applications.
Okay. So yeah. It's just the serendipity of that issue showing up.
Yeah, yeah. It was based on when I heard about it. Maybe it was actually a few months later, because Lucius Shepard also wrote an essay about Clarion for Asimov's a few months later, about the experience of being a student at Clarion.
Right. So you would have gone regardless of who the teachers happened to be that year. This wasn't one of those, it's that
so,
year because,
yeah.
Oh, there's this one person I would really like. For me, it was Tom Dish. I mean, I love them all, but I mean, it was Tom Dish who I adored growing up.
Yeah.
And wanted to learn from. So you were just going to...
I was going to go no matter who was the teacher, really. But I knew that Damon and Kate would be
at the end. Yeah.
At the end, yeah.
And who were the other four?
It turned out to
was
be...
Was it still Robin Scott
really,
Wilson at the beginning?
Really great.
Or no?
It wasn't him. Our first week was... Who started? AJ started.
Okay.
Aldous Budras.
He was my second week in 79.
He was number one. Week two was Joe Haldeman. And when I found out about that, I was really excited because I had read, you know, The Forever War, like probably everyone in all my friends in high school. Mm-hmm. Week three was Elizabeth Lynn.
Uh-huh.
And week four, wait, I might have three and four reversed. But anyway, next was Michael Bishop. And that turned out to be just fantastic for me, I think. I really, really bonded with Mike. Michael Bishop and I carried on a correspondence for several years after that, and he kept reading my stories and critiquing them for me and giving me advice, and even once gave me an introductory letter to Gardner Dozois when I was sending something to Asimov's.
Oh, really? For a particular story?
For a particular story that he liked.
What story was that?
I do not remember now.
The Clarion story.
Yeah. It wasn't a Clarion story. It was something that I had written after Clarion, because I would kind of, you know, presumptuously send Mike my stories as I was writing them, and he would very generously critique them. In one case, he really shredded a story that I sent him, and that was a memorable letter. It was very instructive, but he was super nice about it, but he didn't hold back from saying this is a really
lazy story. Well, by then he knew
you
already survived Clarion, right?
Yeah,
so
yeah,
you,
exactly.
He had already judged whether or not you could take it.
Yeah.
So who were you at age 17? That you, I mean, in that, by which I mean, you know, what is it that you needed, that you were hoping would happen when you arrived there?
Well, obviously, what I was hoping would happen when I arrived there was everybody would see what a genius I was, and how remarkable my stories were, and what a rare talent I was.
Yes, and you don't need us. Why did you come here? You
exactly.
should be teaching us.
Exactly. And it would be, you know, I would meet the right people, and it would be my entree into the world of publishing. It didn't exactly work that way. The first story that I turned in for the workshop got absolutely destroyed by everybody, and it was a situation where it just, you know, I held it together during the critique session, but then I was back in my dorm room in tears afterwards.
That was your submission story?
It was my submission story, but during my instructor conference during the first week, AJ had offered some suggestions for revising this submission story. So that's what I did the first week at Clarion, and I got critiqued early the second week.
I was very lucky, by the way. My submission story did not get critiqued. We somehow used up all the time that first week and moved on to the stories that were written there. So I was sort of grateful for that. I wasted. So I missed that first attack and deconstruction.
I could have done without it, but I think it was actually a pretty good experience for me, a learning experience. The one person who did like my story thought it was a satire, and so he had told me before class, it's going to be great, everyone's going to love this, and they did not, it was not a satire.
Did you let him know it was on satire?
I didn't, because he did not tell. He did not say that to me before class. He just thought it was. Yeah, he thought that was my intention, and he had seen what my intention was.
I guess I should ask, is this person one of the people I know? Because it seems I know so many members of your clarinet class and published so many of them, and then didn't publish others I was hoping I'd publish. So,
yeah, no, this was...
I don't know if it was...
I don't think this is one of the people that you would know.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't believe he actually published any science fiction after Clarion.
Okay.
Although he's someone I'm still in touch with, and he does still write.
So how many stories and rejections did you have before Clarion when you showed up in terms of being rejected?
Good question. I had probably submitted stories primarily to Asimov's, but to Analog and a few other places also. I probably had a couple of dozen rejections by that point.
You were used to that.
I was used to the stories being rejected already. And I don't think I'd gotten any personalized rejections yet either.
Okay.
Although I had published a short story in a regional anthology.
I was going to ask, because that was 1985 on the page.
Yeah.
Cut Without Hands was the same year. So that was actually sold prior then?
Sold is a loose term.
Okay. Accepted.
I think I was paid in copies for that story.
So you did not lord it over all the rest of the writers with your...
No.
Story in Latter-day Science Fiction in 1985.
This was Latter-day Science Fiction 2. It was the second anthology in a series. And yeah, it's a really embarrassing story.
Did you write it intentionally for the anthology? Did you have a story on that subject and then said, oh, there's an anthology it might be right for?
No, I saw somewhere a call for submissions for this anthology, and so I wrote something specifically for it. And, you know, it was science fiction by and for Latter-day Saints, and I was a Latter-day Saint, and I felt qualified to submit. I had not seen copies of the anthology. Somehow, the editor lost my address, and I don't know how that was possible, but I didn't even get a copy of the anthology until a couple of years later.
Now, you say it was for by and for... So, meaning I was not supposed to read this, or it was written that only someone, as opposed to your usage of it in other stories, meant to be for anyone.
Right.
This was really meant for, you'll really only like this if you know so much.
Yes. I think that would be a fair statement to make. I mean, it's a free country. You could have read the anthology, but you probably would not have gotten the same experience as a Mormon reading it.
Yes, but when they made the Book of Mormon, they didn't say, this is by and for Mormons.
Absolutely
not. This is for everybody or whatever. You know.
Yes.
So that's not a story you finally remember or wish to collect if you someday put together a collection. Unless a juvenilia.
It would only show up, really, if anyone really wanted to put together the complete William Shun. Which I'm not anticipating anytime soon.
Yeah.
It was a terrible story. It was, but relative to the rest of the book, I think it stood up pretty well. Uh-huh. It was a story about a Latter-day Saint astronaut who was on the space shuttle, and he was having some kind of debate about the existence of God with another astronaut, and there's an accident while they're doing an EVA, and the Mormon saves the atheist and convinces the atheist to take lessons from the missionaries when they get back to Earth. It's something like that. It was just a really straightforward, faith-promoting, dogmatic story.
Okay, and the other character decides to become Mormon at the end? That's the...
I don't think I went that far, just that the character expressed some interest in learning more about Mormonism.
So what did you learn there? How different were you 6 weeks later than you were 6 weeks before, other than learning how to curse. I mean, though actually that is an extremely important part of it, but
I think it was an important part of it. It's not that I learned to curse there. I've written an essay about this, which is actually an excerpt from my memoir, or an outtake that didn't end up in the final draft. But I had plenty of experience swearing before I went to Clarion. It's just that I didn't swear around people that I didn't know really well. Because inevitably it would find its way back to my dad or someone else if I did. Bill's using the F word, and that was not good. So it took me a couple of weeks at Clarion to get comfortable enough around everybody that, you know, at some point the F word did slip out, and everyone was shocked. Everyone at Clarion was shocked, yeah. They thought, oh my God, we've corrupted this poor, innocent little Mormon boy, and they're never going to allow him to come back to another science fiction function ever in his life.
Right, what was the specific incident that elicited your curse? Do you remember what made you explode that day in exasperation?
I don't remember exactly what it was. Maybe, you know, I stubbed my toe or tripped or something. It was something mild, and I said, fuck.
Oh.
It was nothing huge. I didn't say it at anybody.
No. Oh, okay. I guess you just rose to the mean. Okay, I'm around the place where everybody is saying it every other sentence, so I might as well.
Exactly. But it was shocking nonetheless. And I had a heck of a time convincing anybody that, yes, I've used this word before, and it is part of my vocabulary.
Now, when you got home, did you have to train yourself to not use it? Because you probably, during those six, I don't know how far into the 6 weeks, you probably started using it as a casual thing over the course, perhaps. And then you had to remind yourself, oh, now I'm back home in the real world, and I can't do this.
I had a lot of experience, you know, watching what I said, depending on what company I was in. I guess it's the Mormon version of code switching.
Right, so slipping back into that was easy going home.
It was easy. The thing that I did a lot was talk about Clarion all the time.
To everyone back home.
To everybody.
Uh-oh.
Yeah. And yeah, they, I think I got annoying
about
it.
And you could see the eyes rolling.
Yeah. And it also didn't help that someone somewhere had gotten the idea that Ray Bradbury was one of the teachers at Clarion.
Was that a good thing if you're a Mormon or a bad
thing?
They thought you were literally, he was present while you were present at the same time? Or
And I don't know where whoever it was got this idea, but I was going around my hometown after Clarion, and everyone I ran into said, oh, what was it like learning from Ray Bradbury?
Oh, my goodness.
And that was the frustrating thing, because as soon as I said, well, Ray Bradbury had nothing to do with it, their eyes would glaze over.
They
and
no longer they care.
Yes, exactly. But Joe Haldeman.
Who did not raise their...
No.
I know, there are some, unfortunately, people who should be known by the common person, or shouldn't use the word common person, the average person, who are not.
Right.
Who deserve it equally as much as him. So how different were you, aside from this cursing, in your approach to what a story was? I mean, what skills did you learn, or what skills did you have to unlearn?
I learned a lot about the revision process, for one thing, and about finding, you know, writing the story, and then finding out what it's about, and going back in revision to try to reshape the story to fit what was revealed to be the real topic of the story. This was something I started learning right off the bat with that first story that I turned in, my submission story, because I revised everything that was... I revised all the wrong things out of that story.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, what did you take out?
It's hard...
Spontaneity? Because often that's... If you rewrite and rewrite and rewrite, you can take out the original passion sometimes.
It wasn't the spontaneity so much as, I don't know, you know, Clarion was, what, 38 years ago at this point?
So you don't remember every single moment of that transcendent 6-week period?
I don't remember every single moment. There are definitely things that stick out in my mind. One thing, I mean, like I said, I took home some lessons about revision, and the next story that I turned in during the time Damon and Kate were teaching us, a lot of people didn't like. And I was getting, you know, some more bad reviews, not as bad as with my first story, but Kate Wilhelm at the end said, kind of scolded the rest of the class and said, not for not liking the story, but said, you're missing the point of what this story is. And she just drilled right down to what the heart of the story was. And to my own embarrassment, at being a 17-year-old Mormon, she said, this short story is obviously about the sexual awakening of a young woman. And it's like, oh, that's what this story is about. Okay. It was kind of a revelation to me that someone saw that in this, you know, simple story I'd written about
was
a
correct?
Dragon and a woman. In a way, she was correct.
Yeah, by which I also mean is that often we reveal things that we didn't realize we revealed, and people read it and know something about us we might not necessarily have wanted them to know.
Yes. I think there was a lot sublimated into the relationship between the woman and the dragon in this story. So, yeah, she was right. And that that taught me that I wasn't going to get it right the first time, which was something that I think I was guilty of a lot as a teenage writer, and a lot, you know, for years after that as well.
But, so did you, when you came home, hear certain voices in your head reminding, looking over your shoulder, even though they weren't there? I mean, I know I sort of did, but AJ saying this, or you know, Tom telling me, oh, no, don't do that. That's the lazy thing. I mean, did you carry them for a while? It was a while before I would walk down the street and actually hear their voices and the muttering of other people, and they're not here. But 6 weeks of only hearing the same 20 or 25 people talking can overwhelm you.
Yeah, yeah. So I would go back and read some stories and think, oh, this is where Damon is gonna stamp the word shit onto my manuscript. He had two stamps, at least the year I was there, two little ink stamps, and one had a smiley face on it, and the other one had a face that was grimacing and said shit.
How about Kate's red line of death? Was she doing that your
year?
Oh,
yes, she was doing
the
doing
line
it that
where
year.
She would have stopped reading if she was not being paid as an instructor to
read
it.
Yes, yeah.
And as I always said, our goal was to try to get her off the first page. Just get her off the first page and you're happy.
Yep, she was still doing that. My God, she was like the eye of the hurricane at Clarion. Anything wild could be going on around her, and she would just be calm in the middle of it all. And
yes, when all the super balls were flying around the room, or the water gun fights,
or those water gun fights for sure.
Were you doing super ball fights? Was that thing they did? I can't remember. I know I got a ton of super balls out of the candy machine, and we just bounce them off the walls and be dodging them. Like
there were some bouncy balls that I remember, but mostly it was water gun fights.
So what if you hadn't gone to Clarion? Would you have figured it all out on your own, given enough time? Or
I think I would have figured it out in time, but that it certainly accelerated my learning process. And I remember being in my individual conference with Damon and Kate the first week, and they told me, one, that they had loved the original version of my submission story. They, you know, told me it had been, you know, they were telling me how I had revised it wrong, but they said, you are exactly the kind of student that we want at Clarion.
Oh, my.
Because, you know, you had this story had such an explosion of ideas in it, even, you know, it needed discipline, but it was fun and exciting and something that we wanted to see more of. So this is, you're exactly the kind of student we want to reach out to. And Damon told me, he said, you know, you're not going to be Chip Delaney, you're not going to be Isaac Asimov, and start publishing stories at 18. So, you know, don't even try. You know, you're probably going to start selling stories in about 5 years. And he was pretty dead on if you take into account the fact that I spent 2 years as a Mormon missionary after that.
If you subtract those two years
out of the equation when I wasn't really writing very much, it was 7 years from the time he said that until I sold my first professional story. So I was, when I realized that, I was kind of surprised at how close he nailed it.
I wonder when he says you're exactly the kind of student he needs, whether how much of that, I don't know what you said in your essay. I'm convinced that I was allowed in less from the quality of the story that I sent in than from the actual essay, because I begged and pleaded in my essay that I don't want to write comic books anymore, and I need a sharp dividing line between that life and this life. And, you know, and I have a feeling they said, okay, he's a professional writer who's gone the wrong way, let's save him from something.
save him from his wayward ways.
So I don't know if you said anything in your cover letter about...
I have no memory of what I said in my cover letter. It was probably something along the lines of how writing science fiction was the only thing I ever wanted to do from the time I was 10 and read my first Isaac Asimov robot story. So that's what I want to do. And I think this is probably the quickest way to help me learn what I need to do to get there. And if I was being really self-aware at the time, I would have said it'll be really nice to meet other people who are looking to do the same thing also. Because that was one thing that I really did take away from Clarion. And if I was a different person after Clarion, it was because of the just wide array of people that I met and became friends with, because I had not spent a lot of time around people who weren't Mormons since I was about six and we moved to Utah from Los Angeles. So I had this idea that I was going to come to Clarion and be surrounded by a bunch of heathens. Heathens and Philistines.
Well, there were some.
There were. But by and large, they were really nice heathens and good people. And that's what I learned while I was there, that, you know, just because someone wasn't raised the way I was didn't mean they weren't moral people, didn't mean they didn't think really hard about important issues, didn't mean that, you know, that really that they were horrible, irredeemable sinners. And while I was at Clarion, the first 2 weeks, I think, the first two Sundays, I went to church.
You found?
I found a local Mormon church.
Where is it in East Lansing, having been? I have no
idea. I had to walk blocks and blocks to get there.
Were they mostly made up of students, or is there a local community
in
there?
It was a local community congregation. There probably was a student congregation, but this was just community. It was a lot of young families, some single adults, and actually had a couple of women a little older than me who were going to MSU, who invited me to come out to some church activity during the week, which I did, and I didn't have a really great time.
Yeah, they probably thought, uh-oh, what is this guy doing here, going to this thing?
Mm-hmm.
They were probably intent on saving you from the damaging influences or something like that. I don't know. So, and then you get back from Clarion. I mean, I remember getting back from Clarion, and there were reentry issues.
Oh, yeah.
But your reentry issues would be different, because what was the span of time between reentry and going off on your mission? Because, like, for me, it was, okay, what do I do now? I'm trying to write a lot of stories and put things into practice and, you know, the letdown of the end of it all and all that. But I'm not sure how much time you had to attempt to put things into practice immediately before you took off. I don't remember.
I remember being told at Clarion that it was going to take a couple of months for everybody to get back, kind of get back into the swing of real life, and start really applying what we'd learned in our work. And I think I wrote a lot of stories that year after Clarion, because I was conscious of the fact that just 1 year later was when I was going to be required to go on a mission. I turned 18 a couple weeks after Clarion, and at that time, young Mormon men were sent on missions at age 19. So I had a year, essentially, to.
Did you feel a sense of pressure? Like, oh, I better get something really important done before now.
Yeah.
Prove Damon wrong and do it in 1 year rather than five.
That was in the back of my mind. I always had hope that it would happen that way. It didn't, but I think that was a really pressure-filled year for me. But I had graduated early from high school, and I was in my second year of college after Clarion. You know, so I'm trying to excel at school. I'm trying to write all the fiction that I could. And behind this all is just this dread that coming up, I was going to have to take a break from everything and go do something I didn't want to do for 2 years, and not be able to get through college, not be able to keep writing. And I was afraid I was gonna lose the momentum that I had after Clarion, and just maybe, you know, forget how to write if I wasn't allowed to do it while I was a missionary.
So when you are doing that, that meant you couldn't have anything going active in the subroutine in the back of your mind. Your 100% of yourself was supposed to be devoted to working on that.
Yes, that's the way it was supposed to happen.
I mean, let's say it was not writing. Let's say you just like building model airplanes or something. I mean, if you went off there, you put that out of your mind. It's all about serving.
All about serving.
So whatever
God,
the hobby is, forget it.
Exactly. Okay. No building model airplanes. No. When I was a missionary, we were not allowed. I say not allowed. It was against the rules for us to read anything except a few approved Mormon publications and the Mormon scriptures. We were not allowed to watch movies or television. There's no dating. Everything is supposed to be
phones home, right? At that point, contact.
No phoning home. You wrote letters every Monday on your preparation day, which is, they call it a day off, but it's supposed to be a day for studying, for letter writing, for laundry and shopping. And if there's time left over, you can go down to the church and play some basketball with the other missionaries. Yeah. Of course, I did all those things when I was a missionary. Well, I didn't date, but I always went to used bookstores and got little science fiction paperbacks. I remember reading Orson Scott Card's Speaker for the Dead when I was a missionary, which I knew I was not supposed to do, but I did it anyway. I think that came out in 87. I read Millennium by John Varley, and every chance we got, we would go over to the houses of local members, and they would mostly let us watch TV. went to a few
Though they weren't supposed to.
Though they weren't supposed to. And I didn't really write any new stories while I was a missionary, but I did bring files with all my stories, and I kept sending them out and submitting them to magazines while I was
really
while
with
was
the out. Return address being where the mission was.
Yeah, exactly.
There was so you were sending it across the border from Canada.
Yeah, then. Yeah.
So you were dealing with the whole international reply coupon thing that was going on there.
Yeah.
So it was not easy.
It was kind of complicated.
And I know, that'd be funny because I wonder if reading your manuscript they thought you were a Canadian author because of where it came from rather than realizing that you were.
They might have,
you know.
I think, you know, by this time I had developed kind of a correspondence with Gardner Dozois in rejection letters from him. So he knew something about me. He knew other people that I had gone to Clarion with, and so we would gossip a little bit back and forth when I submitted him stories and things.
Mm-hmm. He was intrigued.
He was somehow intrigued, yeah. I also remember sending a submission to Playboy once.
Uh-oh, when that rejection letter came back in the mail, that probably caused a stir.
It did cause a stir. I got in trouble.
Because it was said that at the return address on the letter you got back, right?
It wasn't just that I didn't put, I had a self-addressed
right.
envelope in there that was addressed to the mission office, which was in Calgary, Alberta.
Right.
But whoever sent the manuscript back at Playboy put a stamp in a return address stamp in the upper corner.
Instead of just the address or something.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So it had the official Playboy logo
that
stamped
made it even worse.
In the corner. Yeah, and the mission president intercepted that manila envelope and opened it. Which really upset me.
Breaking federal law on top of everything.
Exactly. Probably breaking multiple countries' laws since we were in Canada. And I did get a talking to for that. I think he must have assumed from the size of the envelope and the thickness that there was a magazine inside.
Oh, that's why. Okay.
Yeah. But, you know, he saw the story inside and the form rejection letter, and I got a real talking to about how I should not be working on my fiction and my writing career while I was supposed to be serving the Lord.
Yeah, it's funny because tell me if I'm right. From his perspective, would he have been less disturbed had it been a copy of the magazine? Because that is a different kind of urge that is not, you know, taking up, why is he thinking about the stories? You know?
Yeah.
Fighting the thinking about women versus fighting the choice of a life of being a writer which is less offensive in the sight of the Lord. I don't know.
It's a good question. I'm not sure, but I'm sure he would have had a much, you know, a much better idea how to deal with it if it had been a copy of the magazine.
I would have liked to have been the fly on the wall as he went, what the heck is this?
Yep.
Yeah. Well, let's jump all the way to the end of this, and we'll skip over why you came back from your mission until a little later. So once the mission was over and you're back home, how quickly was it that you picked up? Okay, now I'm gonna make up for lost time, and I'm gonna start doing stuff, because that would have been. Let's see, you were in Clarion in 85, 2 years on the mission, so you were at the mission 87 to 89 or something, let's say?
The mission was 86 to 88.
Yeah. So you get home, and the first sales are in 93.
92, I made the first sale.
Well, the first publication?
Publication was February 93.
Yeah.
So then Science Fiction Age.
Right, I was not the first story.
No.
I was the second
to be
published. Both published the same year, but the second to be published.
Yep.
So that five-year gap, or whatever it is, 89 to 90, well, three-year gap, I guess, 89 to 92. I'm not doing my math right. Forgive me. I'm
88 to 92, yeah, 4 years.
High on fried mushrooms here. But so what was going on in that period? So you get back and you say, I'm going to devote myself again? Or?
Yeah, I got back and plunged right back into college almost immediately. I figured out that I wanted to be a computer science major, and I would do a minor in English at the same time. And I worked really hard. I wrote a lot of stories during that period. I remember sitting in the library at the University of Utah, writing and researching stories. I was working in the financial aid office at the University of Utah and writing stories on my computer on the WordPerfect software they had there, and putting them on a floppy disk to take home and continue working on them. It was always, writing was always the thing that was primarily on my mind. Mm-hmm. And in 92, I was actually in a creative writing class, and we were setting up before class, and I heard a throwaway line someone said out the corner of my ear. It's like, well, from my point of view, they moved to the left. And I thought, oh, there's an interesting title for a story. And so I wrote down the title, from our point of view, we had moved to the left, and then tried to come up with a story to go along with it. Yeah. And that was... ended up being my first published story, and I sold it to one of my Clarion classmates.
I know, Chris Rush.
Chris Rush, yeah.
Now, how did that feel, submitting to someone you knew?
It felt very strange. I thought, wow, everybody from Clarion everyone who really seemed to keep seriously writing was just leapfrogging me in their accomplishments. And Chris had suddenly become editor of FNSF, and I think, you know, she rejected a few stories from me too, but was very encouraging. She's like, I'd love to see something from you that I can use. And when I sent her this story, I did, I think, four different sets of revisions for her before she finally bought it. Yeah, she seemed to have been extraordinarily patient with me and gave me a lot of chances to get this story right, whether because she saw something, she must have seen something good in the story, but I don't know if she would have done it for someone who she didn't already know.
I don't remember that I asked for rewrites on these. Did I?
I remember you asking
Ishmael in the Dark.
I don't think you really asked for any rewrites on that. Or maybe, you know, line editing, but I don't think I had to do anything major with that story. That story, incidentally, Colin and Ishmael in the Dark, grew out of a writing exercise in one of my writing classes in college. They said, take a few minutes and write a scene entirely in dialogue. And I started writing this weird story about a prisoner and a jailer in total darkness. And a couple months later, read over what I had already and said, oh, I suddenly know what's going to happen in the rest of this story. And I wrote the rest of the story mostly entirely in dialogue also.
Yeah. Isn't it wonderful when that happened?
It's great, you know, and I loved it.
When you see what hadn't been visible before. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to remember whether that story was published as D. William Shun.
Mm.
And when along the way, how many stories in you decided, forget this D thing, I'm just going William Shun. Was there a particular reason that you used it and then a particular reason you dropped it? All those other William Shuns out there you were trying to differentiate yourself from?
Well, my full birth name anyway, is Donald William Shun II. I have the same name as my dad, and I had always been, you know, William's my middle name, but my dad had wanted to be called Bill when he was growing up, so he was upset that he was named Don, so he called me Bill, and to distinguish ourselves from each other, I always wrote my name as D. William Shun.
And rather than the second, or whatever.
Exactly. And I thought it looked kind of high class having a first initial, but a few years after that, when I ended up leaving the Mormon Church, My dad and I had a huge falling out. I was really angry with him. He was really angry with me, and I'm like, I'm going to show you. I'm not going to use this name anymore. And I got all my ID changed to just William Shun. And
so they screwed him.
So I really showed him. I remember you asking me. I had submitted a story as D. William Shun. You bought it, and then I asked, I would like to change my byline to just to drop the D. And you asked me, are you sure you want to do that? Yes, yes, I'm absolutely sure.
Well, once you do it, you don't want to confuse people and go back. Because sometimes these things just happen from copywriting editors where the editor did it wrong. You know, because you might have a byline and a, well, this is how you pay me as, and they're two different things and it switched up. So, yeah, and that was the first year of Science Fiction Age. That was very early on. Well, within the first year. It's actually the second year, but only one issue came out in 92. The November issue, and then, so it was within the first six issues.
So I made it into the first,
the first
year of publication.
Yeah.
No, that was really exciting. I loved seeing that story in print, and especially seeing it so well typeset and laid out next to a really cool illustration.
Oh, I was so loved doing that, and so sorry it went away. It was a good 8-year run.
It was a really, really excellent magazine, and I was always really, really happy to be associated with it in any way.
Well, it was great having you be a part of it, though.
Well, thank you,
William.
And I'm not just saying that, Bill.
Nor am I.
I keep in the back of my mind.
I was joking. I call you Bill. I don't go all formal.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, in my bio on Twitter, for my pronouns, I say, you know, I use my professional name, which is William Shun, but my pronouns are he, him, Bill.
Right.
Because I want people to call me that.
I know, and there are people, to be honest, there are friends even now who I'm not entirely sure what to call them because I've never called them anything. If someone uses all their initials, and I have no idea, gee, what do I call them if I saw them on the other side of the room and shouted at them, and I don't quite know what the...
Yeah.
You know, which version of their name is actually the name, because we just hang out. And it seems odd how many years into a relationship to say, oh, by the way, you know, how do I refer to you in an informal, casual way?
Yeah.
But I should get some of those out of the way. But
yeah.
But anyway, it took about a decade for you to get on the Nebula balance in 2002. So that's almost a decade later after those first sales, Dance of the Yellow-Breasted Luddites.
Mm-hmm.
So when that happened, were you thinking, well, it's about gosh darn time that someone paid attention to me? Well, what was that experience like when first got that nomination?
It was really thrilling. I did, you know, part of you is always going to think, at last they are recognizing my genius, but I was not so confident about that story anyway. So
really?
It was really, yeah.
I mean, so it wasn't when you wrote and said, I really... powered up on this one, and this is the one that's better than all the others, so it's obvious that this should be noticeable. You just thought it was like any other Shun story.
I did think I had powered up on this one, but I was still unsure about it, because up until this point, I'd been writing some soft science fiction, fantasy, and some horror-tinged fantasy stories. This was my first attempt in a really long time, probably since I was a teenager, to write a story that was more, you know, space opera. Like, it was set on a distant planet, it involved hard sciences, and it was a big swing for me, because it was the first time I was writing the kind of science fiction that I had grown up reading and that I really, really liked.
Yeah, I'm not sure if I heard you read that one at a Worldcon. Did you read that one?
I don't know if I didn't do very many readings of that story, I don't think.
I heard you do a reading at Chicago Worldcon? I don't know. Okay. Maybe some other one.
Yeah. No. But I was really gratified. And it was at the Nebula weekend, I think, when that story was up. I went to a panel, and Gardner Dozois and Nancy Kress were both on the panel. And someone mentioned my name in some way, and Nancy Kress said, "Oh, is William Shun here?" It's like, I really loved that story from the Endangered Species Anthology. I think it's fantastic with the way you used biological sciences and evolution. And Nancy Kress loved it, and then I didn't care if anyone else liked it or not. I'm like, oh, this is fantastic. And Gardner said, "Why don't you two get a room?"
Uh-oh.
But that was just Gardner.
Yeah. So what kind of nominee were you? Would you... well, first there's the Don't Tell Anybody for a week, or how, you know, until the announcement. Oh. And then up until the... Not, were you able to enjoy that time between finding out and not knowing whether you won or lost, or were you a nervous wreck? Were you able to have fun with it, or?
I was somewhere in between. I had fun with it, and I was a nervous wreck. You know, I was a bit bipolar about it all. You know, I wrote a set of notes in case I won, which I didn't think I was going to need, but did not want to be marooned without them if I did. But I think it was Kelly Link that won in that category that year, which, you know.
It's good to hear you say, I think, because that means you're not holding a terrible grudge all these years.
No, Kelly, I like Kelly a lot. Kelly is obviously an amazing writer, and she's really cool, too. So.
I was just reading her new collection. That's how I spent my time on the flight here, reading her. And I'm going to get it wrong. Is it White Cat, Black Dog, or Black Cat, White Dog?
It's
White
one or the other. I'm trying to picture the cover.
I think it's White Cat, Black Dog. Yeah. If I'm wrong, it is a magnificent work. And, boy, one of those stories in there that I read totally ripped a hole in my heart, which is a single word that I got to in the last paragraph, the word perhaps, in one of the stories in there. But anyway, Kelly is wonderful.
Yeah, Kelly's great. I have that book sitting in my to-be-read pile.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Yeah.
It's wonderful. Yeah. Read the first half of it on the way, and I'll read the other half on the way home after this is over.
Nice.
So four years later, you get a trifecta of nominations. You get the Sturgeon, the Nebula, and the Hugo for Inclination. You think, okay, now I'm really getting my act together here. It's all coming together now.
I did think that. Yeah. That was a story. That's one of the few stories I've written, and this has only happened to me a few times, where I finished that story and I thought, this is a big one. This is going to sell pretty quickly and get some notice. And it did. It did. I think.
Did it sell the first time out of the gate, or?
I think I sent it to Gordon. Was it Gordon then? I don't. Probably Gordon at FNSF.
Well, would it have been Gordon? Because it would have been Chris.
Chris was only there for a few years.
That's true. Then Gordon wrote the magazine.
Stories.
And,
yeah. Okay. Gordon bought the magazine, and so Gordon passed on Inclination, and so I sent it to Sheila, and she took it. She didn't take it right off. She asked for a few revisions, but they weren't terribly difficult revisions, and I did that pretty quickly and turned the story around very fast, and she took it. And it wasn't just that I'd finally sold a story to Asimov's. It was I'd sold a novella to Asimov's.
Yeah. How big a novella was it? It was over 17.5, right?
Yeah,
the quality of the novella.
It was on the low end. It was about 20,000 words.
Yeah, that's a huge chunk of the issue back when they were not double-size issues yet. So.
Yeah. Although this one was a double issue.
So it was an anniversary issue or something?
Yeah. It also had The Walls of the Universe by Paul Melko, which also ended up getting Hugo and Nebula nominations, and which we both lost. But
yes, I've only lost editing Hugo's. All of my predictions, you know, you were saying you write a story and you say this is the story. Every once in a while I have one of those and I said, okay, it's all come together, this is about as good as I can make it happen, it will be noticed. And then it's not. I still feel that same way about the story. I said, okay, this is the absolute best I could do at that time, and it sort of sank without a trace. which just says, well, you got to keep writing even better stories, mm-hmm. is what it tells you. So that, but there are ones that surprise me and ones that don't surprise me that nobody really paid attention. There were ones I think, no, this is going to jump out. And readers will like them, but they don't, you know, haven't made any awards. Well, the Stokers have. I've gotten all the Stoker Award nominations. I mean, 0 and 8 over there, but anyway.
The Susan Lucci of, of the Stokers.
At 8. And I'm 2 ahead of anyone else. There's some 0s and 6s, so no one's catching up anytime soon. Well, we have yet to see a full novel from you, but there is a novel out there. You have written an 805-page manuscript, 175,000-word novel, Technomancers, right, which exists. And you began it in 2009, and you started serializing it on Substack. So
that's true.
Tell me about the history of it. What it was that made you say, aha, I have found a novel that is worth writing, and what is its checkered history?
It's a very checkered history, and I still don't know whether serializing it on Substack was a good idea or not. But I had tried to turn Inclination, that novella, into a novel, and somehow every attempt I made it went off in the wrong direction, and I got lost, and I was maybe a year into trying to do that when an idea for a novel just came to me. It was based on an idea about kids using magic that was based on gestures. And suddenly I had the idea of setting it in my neighborhood in Chicago, where I was living at the time. And a couple of characters just kind of popped into life. And I started writing the first chapter almost as soon as I got the idea. At the time, I was new to Chicago, having moved there from New York, and I had joined a place called Writer's Workspace, where writers would just pay a monthly fee and go sit in a cubicle and write, and then we could talk shop in the kitchen. And one day, instead of working on Inclination, I started this other novel, and I got really caught up in it. Worked out the magic system, worked out, you know, basically everything that was going to happen, and I spent the next 3 years writing that novel and then doing 2 more drafts of it. And my agent at the time was pretty excited about it, and sent it out, and it never really went anywhere. And when I changed agents later, my new agent had some further suggestions for revision that I tried to do, but it didn't really work. And I'm not sure how saleable that novel even would be these days if it was.
Well, I mean, do you think it had been saleable, but the times moved on, and certain type of novel?
It could be. I was writing a novel where one of the major characters was an Indian American teenage girl, so you know, there's kind of an inherent problem with representation there.
Yeah.
And there are things that happen later in the novel that kind of, I think, ameliorate that. But still, I'm not sure. Really, I don't know if I'd be able to sell it today if it was in saleable shape. So, you know, a couple years ago, I decided as an experiment to, I had a Substack already, so I created a paid version of it and serialized the novel for anyone who was willing to pay for a membership. It was basically $18. And, you know, I didn't even really get any feedback from the people who did read
it. Oh, really?
It. Yeah.
Could you tell how many reads you were getting?
Oh, yeah, yeah. I can tell.
So, did you get the whole thing up there?
I got the whole thing up there.
All 175,000 words?
Yeah, yeah. And it's a... I think the draft that's up there is not quite that long. But it had gone through... It went through several title changes. It went from Technomancers, which gave a lot away, to Endgame, to Waking Vishnu, and finally the version I put up online is called Root. But yeah, did not set the world on fire. And it was going to be the first novel of a trilogy, but it That's probably all going to remain unwritten.
I mean, is it read? Yeah. If I were to read it, would I recognize it as ending unfinished and needing two more books, or
it could have two more books,
but they're not necessarily necessary? I mean, I would be happy as a reader anyway. Or
I think so. Yeah. I think you might think, wow, I really wonder what's going to happen next, but I don't know that that it demands a sequel.
Yeah, because there are some novels that end, and the final mood of the last scene is, okay, we've taken care of this, now let's go off and conquer the universe. And, and you leave it hopeful that they will succeed. Mm-hmm. We didn't necessarily have to see it. And then the book does well, so someone says, well, I guess I better write the book where we actually see it happen.
Yeah.
But it could have just ended with that triumphal moment when you feel that all good things are planned. So it's not...
Yeah. This book ended on a somewhat ambiguous note. Where the main character was about to learn something about her father that would have been interesting to know, but wasn't really necessary. It was not necessary to the story, but it was important to her. I feel like it ends the same way. Did you ever see the television series Terriers on FX with Donald Logue?
No.
It's a series that should have been renewed for a second season, but wasn't. But where they ended it was a good note where it could have gone either way. It was a good place to end, or it was a good jumping off point for the story to continue. A little ambiguous. That's where I ended Root.
Okay. Well, are there any other novels percolating somewhere, or did that burn you so much that you said, I'm not going to... There's a lot of time in getting a novel done versus the short number of short stories you could do in the same amount of time.
Yeah, I feel like novels tend to take over my life, and so I kind of shy away from starting them, honestly. And I do have another novel that's partway done.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
It's an active creation at the moment? Or
It's not...
I don't mean this weekend, but I mean it's something that you...
It's not the thing that it's at the top of my agenda in my writing life right now, but it's something I plan to get back to. Because it's got a pretty strong first 100 pages, I think. Mm-hmm. But it's not science fiction. It's a crime novel that I sort of envision, when you envision who would you like to see publish this novel, it's like a hard case crime.
I have been writing a couple of short stories that are crime related, and sort of, what do you do with them? You send it to Alfred Hitchcock's Mystery Magazine. They sit in it for a year, and then
Then
you send it to Ellery Queen. They reject it in 2 weeks. Then there are a whole bunch of online little magazines.
Yeah.
But it's not as if there's any big other magazine.
Yeah, there's not a big...
Occasionally there's an anthology. So, I mean, I write them because, well, that's the next... I don't decide what I'm going to write. The story decides what I'm going to write next. And if it's if that's the one that is tickling me, well, that's the one that will get written. And someday, even if I can't publish them, they'll end up being in some collection somehow. And then the people who are expecting only science fiction or fantasy will say, what's this doing in here? And they'll be mad. But
That's the way it goes. I'm the same way. I write what I feel like is speaking to me at the moment.
Yeah. Well, other than the novel and talking about what's speaking to you, we'll get all the way around to other things you remember. For I think of this alternate timeline where... The Accidental Terrorist had been published the way it was intended to have been published. That is, I remember reading The Accidental Terrorist, your memoir, about your time on the mission before and why there became an after. And my feeling was, oh, we're going to see Bill like on the news as a talking head, and this is going to be a major... book published by a major publisher and a major memoir, and then 9/11 happens and that craps all over, I mean, compared to the deaths of 3,000 people, I mean, that's
a minor thing, but
my assumption was that that's what we're going to have. We're going to not see you in the science fiction world anymore. You're going to be one of these David Sedaris people out there.
Yeah, one of those breakout stories, never to return to the fold.
Yeah, I mean, are you able to let go of that? I mean, I know it had to be heartbreaking when you had other things to worry about. You're in New York and 9/11 happened, but so you were distracted from taking it personally. But
I was. I'd had a version of the story of my mission experience on my website for a long time already, 1995. And when I got my first agent, who was Shauna McCarthy, one reason she snapped me up as a client was because I pitched her the idea of the accidental terrorist, that I was going to take this story about my mission and the absurd things that I did and that happened to me as a memoir, and she was like, oh, start writing that right now. Mm-hmm. So I did, and the first draft of that book was huge. It was 250,000 words. It ranged everywhere, and I tried writing different chapters in different styles. It was going to be like this postmodern behemoth, kind of a gigantic literary calling card or something. And Shauna started sending the manuscript out when the first draft was about half written, and she got a lot of interest.
Oh, really? Oh, she didn't wait until...
She did not wait until it was done. She was really on top of it.
Wow.
And we got some very strong interest. And then, as you say, 9/11 happened before all the editors had gotten a chance to see everything. A couple places had already passed on it by that time. But then one of the publishers we were most excited about came back with a letter saying, nowadays a novel where the hook is someone committing an act of terrorism, or a memoir where the hook is an act of terrorism, is deeply unbuyable in this climate.
It would have been interesting to live in a world, I don't like to do hypotheticals with death and everything, had they bought it and then that happened. What the heck they would have done?
That's another question.
What would they have done? Would they have said, "Okay, here, we're going to give you a kill fee, goodbye," or we're going to figure out a way to? Because the title is so persuasive. The title on its own, separate from the book, it really captures your interest. So there's no way the title. I don't know what your title is. It just doesn't have that in there. And
I did have an alternative title ready to go if the accidental terrorist had been too off-putting, but the whole book became too off-putting in some way, but I would have been perfectly happy calling it Missionary Man or something of that sort, and trying to get get permission to use a quote from the Eurythmics song as an epigraph.
Because I was sort of thinking, well, who's going to play Bill in the movie?
That was a fun game to play for a while. Yeah. Because
I thought it would be that big. I really did.
Because, well, before this also, when I had published a very, very early, very rough version of the story on my website, someone who worked at CAA in Hollywood, at Creative Artists, contacted me, just somehow figured out where I worked in New York. This was 1996.
Were you at Sesame Street or something?
No, I was not. I was not yet at Sesame Street. Yeah. I was working at an insurance. I don't even remember the term for what kind of insurance this was, but it was it was corporate insurance, or insurance for corporations.
It would be funny if you worked in one of the companies that sold insurance for if your plane is hijacked. There are rich people who have that, kidnapping insurance and things like that.
It's quite possible that that's what they did. I don't know. I was just a technical writer, but I was working, suit and tie job in a skyscraper at the very southern tip of Manhattan, and get this call from Hollywood, from this guy who said, "I'm reading your story online, and I think it should be a screenplay, and I think we should write it together.
Oh, my.
And we wrote a screenplay. We went through a few drafts, and it actually got optioned for a hot second.
Wow.
By Dave Thomas of SCTV fame.
Yeah, because if it was Dave Thomas of Wendy's fame, no, it would be a strange movie.
Exactly. Exactly. Right. I think, you know, the Canadian angle, I think, worked in our favor, but... Dave Thomas sent us the contract, and they wanted to option it for $0. And I told my I told my co-writer,
that's not an option.
That's not really an option. We shouldn't do this. And he was like, yeah, we're gonna do this. This is our way in. And a couple of days later, the business manager for the production company, who was Dave Thomas's brother, read our screenplay and essentially ripped up the option.
even though they paid nothing for it,
they said we're not binding ourselves to this. And my co-writer was very upset, but I said, you know, they weren't paying us any money anyway, so we haven't really lost anything.
So your co-writer worked at CAA.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, so you don't, so it's a jointly written screenplay, so we don't get to see it because it's not something you could publish as an adjunct to the special edition of The Accidental Terrorist.
Oh, I could, I'm sure. We worked on it. There were three of us that worked on it. This guy's name was Christopher Rivera, and he had a partner, James Callen, that they wrote screenplays together. And so the three of us had written this screenplay, but I could probably get permission if there was ever an occasion to publish it, I could probably get permission from them to do it.
Mm. Well, if anyone would be listening to this without knowing what the book is about,
they're probably very confused.
Well, I will in the introduction explain the circumstances that do not allow you to be allowed into Canada, which I found out about because we met in 1992, and in 1993 the Worldcon was in Winnipeg, and I think I was doing, well, Bill, see you next year in Winnipeg, and you would know you won't see me next year in Winnipeg because I am forbidden to go into Canada.
Yep.
For calling in a bomb threat on a plane.
Yeah.
Notice how my voice did when I was saying that. Even though
it's not something you want to say really loudly, even in any crowded place. Yeah.
You know, get out of my restaurant. But it's definitely a wonderful memoir, and I of course preferred the initial edition because of all the people I knew at Clarion, the part that you had to cut down because it's not of interest to people outside science fiction to know the, you know, 8 chapters on the inner workings of what, you know, Bob Howe and Chris Rush and Dean Wesley Smith and Jeff Landis, right?
Dean wasn't at our Clarion. I think he was a couple years later, but Jeff Landis, Mary Terzillo, Martha Sukup, who else would people know?
Yeah, so there's a whole interest outside of...
And Rob Latham also, who's a very respected academic writer on science fiction now.
That's right, he became that.
Yeah.
So I was interested in that section, which sadly had to be lost, and I recognized it had to be. That's part of why it was such an overly long manuscript. Because,
yes.
You know, there...
For me, when I was writing the first draft of that manuscript, I think that it was really important to depict Clarion in some detail because that was where, you know, I first started. That was the first experience that started shaking up the way that I looked at the world and the way I looked at, you know, the people around me. And I actually got the idea to commit the bomb threat from a picture that a couple of the students, a couple of my, you know, fellow students had sent out to everybody just a couple of months before the incident where they were at, these were a couple of real pranksters from our class. They were posing at the airport next to a sign that said, do not joke about bombs, guns, things like that. All such, you know, threats will be taken seriously.
This was after you'd done it or before you'd done it?
This was before I'd done it, a couple months before. So I'd seen this, you know, them posing with this sign, and so that kind of planted a seed in my head.
Wait, so you mean it's their fault? It's
not well, fault. I'm not gonna go so far as to say that they were responsible, but they definitely planted the seed for me.
Okay.
Yeah.
Are these ones I know? We can blame it on Bob. I believe.
Oh no! You know Risa Nelson. She
oh yes.
One
oh, that's right. Yeah, Risa. Yeah. We forgot to mention Risa.
We forgot to mention Risa.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Another former guest on this podcast, and I can't remember whether
that.
She discussed her clarinet experience, so people could go back and. Well, and I also had Mary on the show, so I mean. That's very funny. I've had so many people from that 1 year. I could sort of clip together a story just to be 1 year, but I can't remember how much detail I went into with those.
Yeah.
But you can go back and listen to those people.
I will. I missed both those episodes.
Yes, so, we now have durian ice cream here, so we shall taste the durian ice cream for the benefit of our listeners who've never had durian ice cream. I've eaten durian.
And describe our
I've eaten our, durian. Let's see
the
how
central
this compares
experience
with durian. Interesting.
That is interesting. The flavor is a little sharp to me, but mildly so.
Yes, well,
what
you miss with actual durian to me tastes as if you've taken onion and mashed it together with pineapple. So it has a stringiness to it. The way you eat pineapple, you know, it has
yeah,
that stringiness
yeah.
to it.
Yeah. I'm getting both of those tastes here. It is a little oniony, and it's a double taste,
which you have, there's an initial sweetness, followed by that onion flavor,
mm-hmm.
which is like a collaboration, which allows me to segue here, because collaboration is a thing I cannot do. If you, Bill, if you and I, despite our friendship, were to collaborate on a story... We would never speak again, and then we'd blow on the floor. And I know you collaborated with Daryl Murphy.
I did collaborate with Daryl Murphy.
On Cast a Cold Eye. P.S. published it back in 2009.
Yeah.
How did that happen, and how did you accomplish it without hating each,
killing
well, you,
each other?
You're still friends?
We are still friends.
Okay,
I saw him maybe about a year ago in New York,
okay.
and his wife.
Well, tell me about that, the act of collaboration, why it was a collaborative story, and how you did it without killing each other.
It's interesting because it's the only real collaborative story that I've written.
I don't think when I looked at the ISFDB, I did not see other names listed as other collaborators.
There's a... there's a story that I published in an anthology called Glitter and Mayhem that was a collaboration with my ex-wife. But she kind of didn't want her name on the story.
Oh, really?
Because we were going to write it together at first, but I ended up doing all the writing. But some of the background and a bit of the plot came from her. So that's another collaboration. But... That was certainly very different from the way that Daryl and I collaborated. I met Daryl online initially, like you meet so many people in this business, because he was living in Logan, Utah, while his wife worked at the university or at Utah State University, and he knew my name from other writers in the area, knew that I was an ex-Mormon, and just emailed me out of the blue to kind of ask me questions about, you know, what's the deal with these Mormons anyway?
Because he's not Mormon.
Because he's not
Mormon.
But
he's from Utah.
No, he's not from Utah.
Or he was living in
Utah. He was living in Utah.
Oh, yeah.
He and his wife are Canadian. So that, you know, that was another point of interest. He was from a country that I could not go to.
Yeah.
And we became, you know, we became friends online because of that. And a few years later... He emailed me and said, you know, I've got an idea for a story. I've started writing it, and I kind of don't know what to do with it, and I feel like you might. So I wondered if you'd be interested in collaborating in any way. I said, sure. So he sent me the fragment, the idea that he had, and we just started each writing as much as we wanted to, and when we got stuck, we'd send the manuscript back to the other guy and went from there. And that process went on for 3 years. This was not a fast collaboration. because I don't think it was a, it wasn't the main project at the time for either one of us. But eventually we had a finished manuscript. We hashed things out a little bit more, and Daryl was ready to send it out, and I said,
well, tell me about when you say hash things out. I mean, explain the hashing part. See, that's what interests me. There's a difference of opinion. I want to go this way, you want to go that, or I like that. Because you can kill your own darlings, but when you're killing other people's darlings, that's...
Yeah. Well, I think maybe Daryl was kind of just wanting to be to have this done with. I shouldn't speak for him. But he certainly was ready to send it out. And I said, no, I think we're doing some things wrong. And I proposed some rearranging of what we'd already written and, you know, taking some things out, adding some things in. And Daryl was like, all right, sure, go ahead, do that, and let's see. So I did another draft of the story and then sent it to Daryl to do a final edit on everything, a final draft, and we both liked it. And again, it was a novella. We sent it first to Gordon at FNSF, but he didn't want it. So Daryl said, let's try PS Publishing. And they took it. They took it. They published one of their fancy limited editions of this novella. And got some really good reviews. And sometimes you can find, used copies of it for cheap on eBay. But because it was a limited edition, often the copies of this book are pretty pricey on eBay. At least I can point and say, you can get my book for $75. That's how good it is.
Yeah, instead of however many pounds it would have been when PS was doing it.
Yeah. But it was a good experience, the collaboration. It's certainly not a story I would have come up with on my own. And I think, where it ended up is not a story Daryl would have come up with on his own either, although it was his idea to start with. And we always talked about doing another one, doing a sequel, and just couldn't quite get it together, scheduling or other things. I know Daryl had a sequel kind of all plotted out and sent it to me, and I dropped the ball somewhere along the way. And that was years ago.
The ball could be picked up again.
The ball could be picked up again. Yeah. Yeah. I'm trying to write more now than I have the last few years.
Yeah. What brings that about?
It's time. I've been missing it, and during the pandemic, my day job really took over for a while. Then my mother died. It was not COVID. It was ALS. And I got the opportunity to suddenly start working for myself. I had there's a website that I work on, Spelling Bee Solver, which is a website that offers hints for the New York Times Spelling Bee, and that's become my major project in the last few years. And I'm working on, my own word puzzle game called Tylogram, and that's taken up a lot of my time. But both of these things are to the point that they're somewhat self-sustaining now. I still have to do daily maintenance on them, but I've been itching to get a lot more writing done.
Well, I can understand. This sort of wraps around to the beginning of our conversation, that if you end up being more known for the shun format than for the writing, it could be you're ending up known more for Tylogram than for the fiction. And you don't want that to be, even though it would be satisfying, because you've made up something that people love.
Yeah.
But still, I know inside you want the stories to take precedence.
So. Yeah. So I would like to get back to it. And, Spelling Bee Solver is popular enough that it now appears in my Wiktionary or my Wikipedia entry. That's one of the notable facts about me. Yeah.
Now, is your Wikipedia entry truthful and factual, or are there?
It's a little shaky in a couple of places.
Yeah, because there are things in mine that are wrong, or incomplete. that you say, well, how do you mention X and not Y when Y is more important than X? But I do nothing about it because I want to see what the universe thinks of me, not what I would correct. You know, like I edited a magazine that said how many issues, the number of issues is wrong. And it says I've been nominated for 5 or 6 Stokers when it's been 8. And it's like, gee, if someone knew enough to go and edit it and take that time, obviously someone knew about me to do it, then where were they getting the information that they wouldn't have the other two? So I'm curious. I find it entertaining. So I'm not complaining. It's interesting to see what remains after the game of telephone that is the internet.
Yeah, it's interesting. It's interesting that I can still take Wikipedia seriously and use it for research when I know, you know, how kind of shaky some of the facts are in my own article. And I really don't like the picture that they used in mine also.
What picture did they use?
It's a picture, I don't even remember what year it was. It might be from the Nebulas in
2007. Did you have a beard or not?
I had a chin beard, a goatee, and a really terrible velvet blazer or something, or a corduroy blazer. It's just a picture I don't like.
Well, my Wikipedia page is funny because at some point, as you know from running a long time, I lost a lot of weight.
Yeah.
And someone replaced the heavier photo with a thinner photo maybe a year after the heavier photo went up. And the editor's note, because you have to, they go and they write why they did this and why they did that, was I wouldn't ordinarily put up a new photo so quickly, but he lost so much weight I thought I better do it. Is the editor's note. I guess then he seemed to think it would stick. Who knows?
Yeah.
You know, because it could have been they had to flip back and forth between them the way I, you know, my pants life before that.
Yeah.
But enough of that. We're sitting here eating ice cream, talking about how I'm thinner now, durian ice cream. The check has been paid. We're supposed to go back to the Nebula Awards. Not just supposed to. We're going to go back.
We've got to.
So this is your first one in a while.
This is the first conference convention that I've been to in quite a few years.
Yeah, I mean, more than just pandemic time. I mean, it was before. I think I don't remember when I last saw you.
I think after, you know, after I split up with my wife, I kind of dropped out of a lot of social activities.
Right, I'm trying to remember the last time we were physically in the same place. Surely it has been since the icon that got us on television on the episode of the parking lot. Which had to be like 15 or 20 years ago or something.
I'm so happy that that's on YouTube and people can see it.
Anyway, we're going to go. So do you think, are you energized by these things normally? Do you think do you come away shrunken or do you come back energized?
Sometimes I come back energized, sometimes shrunken, but I think this one will be an energizing one. I've got my fingers crossed.
Well, good.
I'm hopeful.
I'm so glad that you came back. I'm so glad we're able to arrange this because since this podcast began, I wanted to get back to New York. And of course, as I told you in the email, you said, I'm not in New York. You're getting back to New York. We're not allowing us to have a conversation, but guess what? I'll be here. So I'm glad we're able to do this.
Thanks for
coming out here to this wonderful restaurant, a wonderful little treasure. So
thanks for having me. I'm really glad it worked out, and it's great to see you.
Great to see you.
And that was William Shun. You can learn more about Bill by following him on Twitter at Shun or by visiting shun.net, and both of those Shuns are SHUNN. And if you'd like to know more about what I'm up to, visit me on Twitter at Scott Edelman or on Mastodon, where I'm at wandering.shop/@ScottEdelman, or head over to scottedelman.com. And if there's anything you want to share with me about this episode or any other or whatever happens to be on your mind, give me a shout at scott@scottedelman.com. And all those Scott Edelmans are ScottEdelman. If that meal has you hankering for more culinary chats with creators of the Fantastic, search for Eating the Fantastic at Apple Podcasts and subscribe, or use the RSS feed, which you'll find at eatingthefantastic.com. That's also where you'll be able to check out a photo of Bill, as well as the food we shared. Once you've done that, I hope you'll take a moment to rate or review Eating the Fantastic at Apple Podcasts and like it on Facebook. because that does affect the rankings there and will allow potential new listeners to have an opportunity to find the show. But if you'd like to help keep new episodes of Eating the Fantastic showing up every other Friday and help keep me out of the red, I hope you'll join the supporters who cover some of the costs of the podcast. The books I buy to keep up with my guest work, the equipment, the bandwidth, the transportation of guests to and from cons and restaurants, and as always, the food, which lowers defenses, loosens those tongues, and sometimes has us forgetting we're even recording a podcast. The easiest way to help out is to simply toss a couple of bucks in the tip jar at paypal.me/eatingthefantastic. If you feel like buying me a cup of coffee, head over to coffee.com/eatingthefantastic, where coffee is ko-fi.com. But if you'd like to feel even more invested with what I'm doing here, you could chip in with a small recurring monthly donation over at patreon.com/eatingthefantastic, where there are perks involved depending on your level of support. A big thank you once again to Alex Under the Sky at Audio Jungle, composer of this episode's theme music. Coming up 2 weeks from today will be episode 200 and my special guest, J. Michael Straczynski, whose 2019 autobiography, Becoming Superman, and 2021 novel, Together We Will Go, are both riveting reads worth tracking down, but he is perhaps best known as the creator of the television series Babylon 5, for which he wrote 92 of the 110 episodes. Now that I've survived May's trips to the Nebula Awards and Balticon, both of which have apparently left me COVID-free, my next trip, 2 weekends from now, is to Pittsburgh for this year's StokerCon. I'm beginning to firm up who I'll be recording with, one of whom will hopefully be an old friend from my time working in the mid-70s Marvel bullpen who happens to live in the area. Wish me luck on that one, because I haven't seen this creator since 1985. And those nostalgia trips are always fun. I hope you'll come back to find out how it went. Until then, may all your eating be fantastic.